one of three states, either Illinois, Wisconsin, or Minnesota. And I'm actually originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, I don't know how I know geography, but I don't know but most Americans don't even know geography. I don't know geography. I'm actually told that there was someone I knew that was studying for a citizenship test, and they were asking, they were going through some of the questions they had to go, and I didn't even know half the questions, not how to answer them. So I would fail citizenship 101. But Chicago, you know, Chicago is like right in the middle of the country, and right above, it's right on the Great Lake on Lake Michigan, and right above Chicago is Wisconsin. And Milwaukee is a town about 90 miles north. So that's where I grew up. And lived there, went to school there, went to college there. But when I was 25, 26 years old, I went to New York City. You've heard of New York City, right? I moved to New York to go to graduate school, and I stayed in New York for 18 years. So I became kind of an adopted New Yorker, and I think when you begin moving around, your accents begin to change a little bit. So I don't have quite the pronounced Midwestern accent that I had. So I would, when I was living in New York, I would go back home, and I would talk to people, you know, that didn't know me, like I'd meet someone, and they would be like, "You're not from around here, are you?" And I'm like, "Well, I only lived here for 25 years, you know." So you begin to change. I haven't quite adopted to Southern speak yet, though. I know the thing most people adopt at some point is y'all. Did you know that y'all? That's it, right? Y'all is singular. You know that y'all, you all, because the plural of you all is all y'all. So I come with my northern friends and they, all y'all, what's all y'all? But I'll probably be saying that in a couple of years. But I lived in New York for many years. I went to seminary in the New York area, and then it was in seminary that I got involved in serving in Chinese churches. I like to give people what I call a riddle. I say, I am a pastor of a Chinese church, but I don't speak Chinese. And then they look at me like I'm crazy or something. And I'm like, well, that's because I'm an English pastor. Most ethnic churches, whether Chinese, Hispanic, Korean, whatever, have younger people, and they usually speak English. Do you know all of the acronyms for Chinese in America? Have you learned that yet? I haven't made this up. I hope it's not racist, but this is what people say. So if you are from overseas, or if, say you're from China or Hong Kong or wherever, you would be called OBC. That thing is called overseas born Chinese. Okay, now if you were born in America, ABC, American born Chinese. If you're born in Canada, CBC, Canadian born Chinese. Now my wife is a little tricky. My wife, Grace, was born in Singapore. She's Chinese. Her family heritage is southern China, so she speaks Cantonese. And she moved to the States when she was like 2 or 3 years old. And then kind of moved back to Malaysia and Singapore for a while, but spent most of her years growing up in the U.S. She is, you know what she would be called? ARC. ARC. American Raised Chinese. So people who are American Raised Chinese say, we're very different from ABCs. ARCs are true. And then, of course, you know, OBCs would be, different from ARP, even though they're maybe a little similar. And so there's different, you know, a little bit cultural understandings, and depending upon where you're on the spectrum. But anyway, I got to learn all this because I was a pastor of a Chinese church for many years. And then we moved from New York down to Raleigh, North Carolina. That's about 4 hours from here. And I was doing my graduate work there and got a doctorate. And then we then I was looking for another church to serve, and the church here called me to be their pastor a little over a year and a half ago. So I'm still pretty new to the area, but I'm glad that I can come to speak with you today. And one of the things when I was in college, I had kind of a little crisis experience when I was probably toward, I would say it was the beginning of my sophomore year. And I distinctly remember sitting at my desk, and I was contemplating the meaning of life. I don't know why I came to this point of contemplating meaning, but I think it was because that until that particular point, things had gone pretty well for me. I was a top student in high school, and I had gotten into the school that I wanted to, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is my home state college, and that's where I always wanted to go, and I got into their honors program, and I was doing well academically, and I had a lot of friends and supporting family. There was really nothing that was lacking in my life, but nonetheless, I felt that there was something missing, and that no matter what I had accomplished, and, you know, it hadn't been that much so far, but I could almost project that the more that I would accomplish in life, there was still something missing, and I didn't really know what that missing piece was, and it was at that point that I began to consider God. I began to pray, and I got involved in a Bible study with some Christian brothers that I knew, and that kind of began my faith journey. And I would say most of us desire a meaningful life, or we seek to have meaning in our lives, and people try to find meaning in a lot of different ways. Some people find meaning through sports. I actually, maybe hard to believe, but I was a big sports guy in high school. I played tennis, and I was a wrestler. And I wasn't a great wrestler, but I had friends that were really good at wrestling, and their goal was to go to the Olympics, but, you know, only a few people get to go to the Olympics, so they were good, but they weren't quite that good, but they had given their lives to wrestling. Of course, there's fans who give their lives to their team. I'm an unusual American. I am a big soccer fan, and my team that I support is, maybe you don't like them, but Manchester United. Okay, well, I would say the same to Chelsea fans and City fans, but I know soccer fans are so intense about being a fan. I know one man that was from England, and his wife said that when it was football Sunday, you know, he would just close all of the blinds in the house and just barricade himself in the room to watch the game. I've heard it's even worse in Latin America. Have you ever heard this? When fans watch soccer, I don't think it happens much, but in South America, fans will watch games, and in the stands, they will make a sacrifice. They'll bring a chicken to the game, and they'll do like they'll sacrifice the chicken to try to get their team to win. Unbelievable. Like that, like soccer takes on a religious significance for them. So some people find their identity in that, or meaning in that. Some people find their identity in academic achievement. I have a friend, a longtime friend, who his goal in life was to get into Harvard University, Harvard Business School. That was his goal in life. The interesting thing was that he did not want to attend Harvard. He just wanted to get a piece of paper to say, I was accepted into Harvard. And so then instead of having a degree from Harvard, he just wanted to put his acceptance letter onto, you know, a plaque or something like that. I don't think he ever did get into Harvard. He's had a pretty good life anyway, but it's interesting, you know, what some people think of will give them meaning to life. Other people try to find it in dating and in relationships. Others try to find it in having and pursuing a good career, either maybe in business or law or medicine or whatever, you know, that you're trying to achieve. People often try to do through academics, through status, through power, and we often strive for such things, and when we strive for them, although many of these things are good things, when we achieve them, we find, and the people often find, that they don't quite meet their expectations. Like, of course, if someone is striving to be a doctor and they become a doctor, I'm sure that they enjoy their practice of medicine and they feel fulfilled in it, but yet that doesn't ultimately fill the hole of meaning in their life. And today we're going to look at a Bible, a character, as someone who actually really lived. He was a king in Israel. He was actually the third king in Israel, and his name is King Solomon. He was the son of King David, and if you know King David, he was the one who fought Goliath and fell the monster, or the, he wasn't a monster, but to them he was, but he was a giant and conquered the Philistines and was a great king of Israel, and then he had his son Solomon, and Solomon extended the boundaries of Israel, and it was a time of peace and prosperity. He built the temple. His prayer we see in scripture to God wasn't that he would be a great king, but that God would give him wisdom. And in fact, he was known as one of the wisest men in the world, maybe one of the wisest men in history. And if you look in the Bible, in the book of Proverbs, it's a book of wisdom, and many, or if not most of the Proverbs are attributed to Solomon. He was a man of great wisdom. And what King Solomon decided to do was he decided to do a great experiment. He wanted to see what his wisdom, he wanted to apply his wisdom in terms of finding meaning in life. And so whatever he did, he wanted to do it as an experiment and kind of keep his mind clear, keep his wisdom intact, but nonetheless try to explore many different areas and venues of life to see if these would be things that provide wisdom and to find meaning, or to have meaning. Now, what we're going to start with, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a book in the Bible. It's a wisdom book. And in we're going to start with chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. And it says here, I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned this too, it's a chasing after him. And so here we see he's applying himself to wisdom and to understanding. And wisdom, what is wisdom? Wisdom is applied knowledge. And we think of someone who's a wise man. I always think of someone wise as Yoda. You know, Yoda from Star Wars. And he's the, what kind of what was Yoda anyways? I don't even know. I don't know my Star Wars that well. But Yoda, you know, the little green guy with big ears. And, you know, he was a wise, whatever he was. And wisdom is someone who practices discernment, understanding, applied knowledge. So it's not just having a lot of knowledge, it's actually applying it to your life. And the goal of Solomon was to apply wisdom to his life and to do this experiment to see what was good in life, what brought meaning, what would fill the hole in people's hearts. And he goes on and gives a lot of different examples of things he explored. He didn't, in a lot of these cases, he will mention the area, and he'll say, well, okay, this didn't, you know, satisfy. He didn't necessarily say why. So in some cases, I'm going to actually theorize as to why he may have said that. So the first thing that he applied himself to was wisdom and knowledge. And in Ecclesiastes 1:18, he says, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge, the more grief. Okay, now I'm going to make a disclaimer here and say almost most of the things that he is referring to are good things in and of themselves. So the pursuit of knowledge is a good thing, and you are students, and hopefully you are pursuing knowledge. The pursuit of wisdom is a good thing. But nonetheless, when Solomon is making this statement, he says that it causes sorrow and it causes grief. I myself, now that I'm getting a little bit older, I think I've hopefully gained a little bit more wisdom in my life. But what I've learned is that even though I think I've become wiser and I have things I can share with others, most young people don't want to hear my grief wisdom. And so I will oftentimes, the pastor, see people make bad decisions, young people make bad decisions, and I want to tell them, and sometimes I do tell them, that really wasn't a good decision, but most people don't necessarily want to hear it. I always like when people are trying to decide what to do. I don't know if you've ever done this or friends like this. You'll ask your friends, is this a good decision to make? Should I don't know, like, go to this school, and you'll talk to 9 friends, and they'll say, no, 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 that's not a good school. Or maybe it's someone to date. Should I date so-and-so? 9 of your friends will say, no, bad idea. But you'll find that one friend who agrees with you, and then because of that friend, you'll be like, oh yeah, my friend agrees with me, so I'm going to go ahead and do that. But wisdom would say you should probably follow the advice of the majority of your friends who know you, who know that that's a bad decision. And so, sometimes with wisdom, I think that can lead to sorrow because you see decisions that people make that are wrong. And I think it can lead to sorrow too in that sometimes you know the right thing to do as a person, but nonetheless you still walk in the wrong path. And so that can be frustrating when you don't follow the path of wisdom, even though you have wisdom. For knowledge, I think knowledge is a good thing, but sometimes when there's knowledge, you think too much, and it can maybe drive you a little crazy. I heard an interest. I have a friend who is a district attorney in Wisconsin, and a district attorney is someone who prosecutes crimes. And actually, my friend now is a judge, so he's kind of moved up. He's a judge now. And he was telling me strategies of trials. And he was saying that for someone, a prosecuting attorney who's trying to send someone to jail, that they want someone who's typically less educated. They want someone, because people who are less educated tend to think in terms of black and white, right and wrong. And they'll see someone and they'll be like, okay, this thing happened and he's guilty. Now, someone who's more educated tends to think with a lot more complexity. And they tend to think in more shades of gray. And when you think in more complexity, you can begin to think, well, maybe he didn't do this crime because of this. Or maybe he didn't do it because of that. And begin to think of a whole lot more options. So most defense lawyers would want to have a jury full of PhDs. Because with those who are more educated, most likely they could get their client off the hook, whether they did it or not. But in thinking with complexity, it makes the world a little bit more difficult to discern and maybe frustrating. And so I think that's a little bit about why maybe Solomon came to that conclusion. But nonetheless, he said wisdom and knowledge are good, but yet it causes sorrow and it causes despair. Now the next passage we're going to look at is going to bring out some more things that Solomon explored. In Ecclesiastes 2, 1 to 3, he said, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good, but that also proved meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. What does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My wisdom, my mind is still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. Verse 3. I tried cheering myself. We did three already. So some things that we see from here that he tried to explore. So one was laughter, and he said that was madness. I don't quite know why he said, I mean, I think laughing is a good thing. But nonetheless, laughter, humor, comedy has a very short shelf life. You know what I mean by shelf life? A shelf life is an expression that something doesn't last very long. So if you get food from a restaurant and you take it home, it has a very short shelf life. It only stays in the refrigerator a couple days and then it'll go bad. Humor is kind of like that. Sometimes you'll hear someone give some good jokes, a comedian, and then you hear it again a couple years later and you're like, how did I think that was funny? Or maybe the other day I was driving up to Princeton, New Jersey for a conference, and I put on the radio, a satellite radio, and I put on the Comedy Channel. And there were some pretty funny comedians, and I was laughing, and you know what? The next day, I would like to tell my wife, oh, I heard this great comedian. I could remember nothing. It just kind of was funny at the time, and then it just goes into the wind. And so, to Solomon, laughter is madness. He also tried drugs. He tried wine. Now, wine isn't probably the worst of drugs, but he tried alcohol, and many people try to self-medicate. And it's interesting because he says here, he tried wine, and embracing folly, my mind still guiding with wisdom. So you get the, you kind of get the impression here that Solomon is drinking a lot of wine. He's becoming very cheerful, but he's like, at the same time, he's like, I'm analyzing this. How does my body feel with wine? How does this make me feel? Does it bring meaning? And a lot of people now, young people, old people, self-medicate. It's not just wine. It's marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamines, you name it. There's so many drugs now. And a lot of people think that they can find some meaning in the drugs that they're taking. But nonetheless, it usually bites them and they end up in a worse place than they want. There's a show on TV, have you ever seen it, Intervention? Intervention is it's a reality show where they'll track someone who's totally addicted to drugs and their family wants to get them help. And usually they just are in such a bad way, but they just cannot see a way out, and they actually don't even want any help. A lot of them will resort to stealing from others just so they can get drugs, but yet they still think their life is okay. And Solomon is saying here, drugs is not the answer. He goes on to say he pursues pleasure. He's pursuing folly, and I kind of view this as that he was exploring having fun. He wanted to have parties, and as a king who had a lot of money, a lot of resources, he could probably throw the biggest, grandest party that you could even imagine. And nonetheless, he would partake in these parties and having a good time, and he said that that he could not find meaning in them. He also then goes on to bring up more areas, and the next one is in verses 4 through 6. He says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit in them. I made reservoirs to water the groves of flourishing trees. And so he tried real estate. So he wanted to buy a lot of things, a lot of houses, mansions, whatever he made at the time. But nonetheless, that didn't really help. I don't know, having lived in New York, I didn't have that much money, so I lived in apartments, small apartments. I think I lived in an apartment once that was smaller than this room. But, you know, it was good for me. I had roommates. But recently there was a show on TV called Buying New York, or Selling New York. Selling New York is about real estate agents who are attempting to sell properties in New York, mainly condominiums. And the average price for these condos is between $10 and $30 million. The interesting calculation is that as a real estate agent, they get about 6%, maybe split it, 3 to 5%. So let's say they get 5%. New York, you always get more money. So a $10 million property, if you're the real estate agent and sell that, you get $500,000. That's pretty good. You're just a real estate agent. But the people that are buying these have so much money. There was the one that stood out to me the most was a condominium that had a pool. Not a pool table. They had like the dining room, the kitchen, living room, and then they had like off to the side an actual swimming pool in the apartment. That apartment was like twice as big as the house that I live in right now. But it was extravagant, and people have the money and they want to spend it. But Solomon is saying here that I took on these great projects, but yet he still found them wanting. He also tried community service. He said that he made gardens and parks and reservoirs with trees, and so I kind of look at this as that he was providing parks and places for people to enjoy. And reservoirs would have been, he would have maybe dammed up a river or done something, a man-made lake, in order to plant these trees for people to enjoy. He had so much money, he could tinker with the environment. I was actually reading, this was probably 10 years ago, but there was a really wealthy businessman from China, a billionaire, and he decided that his town, that he lived in a city, had too much pollution. And so it was surrounded by mountains. I don't know if you've heard of this guy. I couldn't find his name. But he actually cut down a mountain so then the pollution could leave, you know, through that valley. He had enough money to take bulldozers and take down a mountain. That's kind of what Solomon was doing here. He had the resources to change the environment to hopefully help beautify and better the lives of people. He also sought money. He said that he had, in verse 8 and 9, he said that, "I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well with the likes of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me, and all this my wisdom stayed with me." So he then sought silver and gold money. There was actually an interesting study done recently about happiness. I don't know how sociologists do this, but they studied happiness, and they gave people surveys about how happy they were, and they found that people who were in poverty, you might think, had tough lives and were generally not as happy. And you would think, and people who had a lot of money were generally pretty happy. But they found that the tipping point was about $70,000. If people who made about $60,000-$70,000were as happy as people that had more money. And in fact, some people who had more money, the most money, were even a little less happy because they had so much to worry about in their money and their investments. And actually, did you know that half the people who win the lottery in the U.S., they win like a big $100 million lottery, half of them within 5 years or 10 years lose it all. Sometimes they make bad investments, sometimes they just think the money will never run out, and they just spend it. Sometimes people scam them. There's a whole lot of ways people can lose their money. I don't know how people can lose $10 million or $100 million, but they do. But they think they can find happiness in the money, but, you know, they end up waking up the other side of the bed, and they're the same person, and it just doesn't help. He also started relationships. Now, he didn't just have a wife. He had multiple wives. He actually says he had a harem. I think they probably still have harems in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere where you have multiple wives at your disposal. It's a common thing in the Middle East back in his day. And so Solomon, I think, over time had at least 700 wives, 300 concubines, which were kind of like mistresses. And, you know, he found out that this was problematic. There's a show on TV now called Sister Wives. Have you heard of that, Sister Wives? There's kind of fundamentalist Mormons, and Mormonism in the early days believed in polygamy, or having multiple wives. Now, polygamy in the U.S. is illegal, but nonetheless, there's some Mormons who want to practice their religion, and so they will have, a man will have multiple wives, and these wives are called sister wives. So they're kind of like sisters. Now, I've never seen this show, but you can imagine it makes a great reality show because when women are, these sister wives are competing for one man, one husband, there's going to be lots of rivalry, lots of jealousy, lots of problems. And this indeed, in fact, happened in Solomon's life. You read in the Bible that that having all these wives actually led him astray, actually caused him to embrace foreign gods. And so having this harem, these wives, ended up becoming more of a headache than it was worth. He also sought power. He said he became far greater than anyone in Jerusalem ever. Sometimes workers in America, at least historically, especially, and even now today in like factories, there's a distinction between workers and management. And so workers oftentimes unionize, and then management is like, it's like those who oversee them, and often there's a situation where they don't get along that well. And I remember talking to someone who was a worker in a factory, and he got promoted to management. And he said, in being promoted, he lost all of his friends. And most of his friends were those who he worked with, and you would think that he could continue to have his friends, but nonetheless, because he was promoted, now he's management, and he made decisions that impacted his friend's life, and they didn't necessarily like that. And so, in seeking power, he lost friends. And I think for Solomon, as someone of power, that just comes with the reality. You make decisions that people don't like, and sometimes people don't like you, and so it can lead to problems. And so through all of this, then, Solomon looks at it, and he comes to a summary conclusion. And the summary is in verses 10 and 11. He said, "I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure." So anything he could think of that would make him happy, he did. Get more wives, have more wine, better wine, build things, buy things. Whatever it was to pursue pleasure, to pursue meaning, he did. He didn't deny himself anything. And he said, "My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, and what I had both achieved, everything was meaningless, a chasing after wind, nothing was gained under the sun." And so his conclusion at the end of this experiment was that this was meaninglessness. Nothing filled the hole in his heart. In fact, there is a noted scientist named Pascal, and Pascal was also a noted Christian, a believer, and he said that in everyone there is a God-shaped void. A God-shaped void. And that is the hole that was in the heart of Solomon and many people who were seeking me. It was the hole that was in my heart as well when I was in college, and it can only be filled by God. And then the conclusion that Solomon comes to is in verses 24 to 26. And he says, "A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness." And so the conclusion for Solomon in trying to find pleasure in all these different things apart from God was that the person who pleases God is the one who will find happiness, the one who finds satisfaction and enjoyment in God. And so, again, that leads me back to my dorm room so many years ago. Friends invited me to a Bible study, and I began to ask those questions of how can I find meaning in life, and they shared with me a couple of verses of Jesus. And the first is John 10:10, and John 10:10 says, "I have come that you might have life and have it to the full," or all another translation is, "you might have it more abundantly." And so my meaning and happiness was tied up, I would find, in Jesus and the abundant life. And then in Matthew 6, Jesus had an interesting statement. He says, "So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what should we drink, or what should we wear? For pagans run after these things, but our Heavenly Father knows you need them. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." And so that really spoke to me, because all of these things that Solomon tried to pursue are things that we normally, people normally try to pursue, but nonetheless, they do not satisfy. But the hole in my heart was fulfilled when indeed it was Jesus who I decided to follow. Now, I was reading a book recently, and I would, if you're interested at all in getting a better picture of Jesus, and it's especially written for young people, it's a book called One Dot Life. And it's by Professor Scott McKnight, and I liked what he had to write. And this is really my concluding remarks. He writes, "Christianity is not enough. Religion is not enough. Being accepted in church is not enough. Climbing the corporate ladder is not enough. Solving intellectual problems is not enough. Food and drink are not enough. Fame isn't enough. Nothing's enough. Nothing's enough. The only thing that is enough is Jesus. And the only way to get to Jesus is to follow Him. And that means giving your life, your one life, to Him and to His dream. So if you're searching for meaning, it can be found in Jesus. His desire is for you to follow, is to follow Him. He created the universe. He created us. And He knows how we tick. And it is He who can provide meaning. And for those of you who may not know the Lord, may not know God or may not actually be that interested, I would challenge you to think about Solomon and to begin to contemplate the claims of Jesus. And for those who do know Jesus, He's calling us to give our one life to Him wholly, to follow Him as a disciple. And so let's think about these words of Solomon, and we can find, as he concluded, one of the wisest men in the world, that meaning comes from following God, from finding happiness in Him, and Jesus. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I do thank You and praise You for this time that we can look at Your Word, and we can learn from this experiment of Solomon,